In the New Testament. In the New Testament, there are three letters from Paul with a strong overlap between them. Three letters are Ephesians, Colossians, and our book, Philemon. If you go and read them later, make it your Sunday afternoon homework or whatever, you should see that in language and in content, there are links between them. You'll recognise names repeated, maybe, or ideas. Now, we're not certain how they all originated. Like much of the New Testament, we don't have all the details of where the books first arose exactly. We can try and piece together their stories. But maybe it's something like this. Paul wrote some letters to Christians who lived in a valley. The valley was known as it was on the river Lycus. And the area this river was in is a place called Phrygia. Now we would think of it today as Turkey, or part of Turkey. One of the letters went to Christians in a city called Colossae. Now we have that in our New Testament, that is Colossians. The second letter was a short note to Christians probably based in a nearby city called Laodicea. That's in our New Testament. That's Philemon. You might also remember, of course, that Laodicea certainly has a letter in Revelation. And then a little later, Paul decided he would write a general letter to the churches who are on the west of the Lycus Valley. The churches down by the coast and maybe further out as well. So particularly a big church in a large important city called Ephesus. But probably that letter wasn't just for Ephesus, it was probably for the other churches round about. And in that letter he took the ideas he'd written first to the Christians down in Colossae and he developed them. He explained them in more detail. He laid out more clearly his thinking. And that's the third letter in the New Testament, Ephesians. So you have these three letters, Ephesians, Colossians, Philemon, and they have these links between them, these connections. But we don't know exactly how they came about. I've suggested one way. And the reason I'm telling you all of this is because, as I've said to you already, we're going to look at one of those letters. We're going to look today and in future sermons at Philemon. Now already I've preached on Colossians. That was in the evening services of 2016 or 2015-16. More recently Simon has preached on Colossians to us on Sunday mornings. And so what I thought, it would be good maybe, I was trying to think of something short for the next series we did. I thought it would be good to do one of the complimentary letters. Hence Philemon. Now in theory the series could be very short. We could do it in a single sermon. Philemon is 25 verses. Can be done very quick. I've slowed it down on purpose though. And the reason is, its ideas are really quite relevant in our society. See, Philemon, it centres on the relationship between a slave and his master. And it's in an environment where there's harsh talk and there's cruelty. And so Paul, in this letter, in a very personal way, and yet as an apostle of Christ Jesus, tackles both big personal division and social division in the light of Christ. And I think that's something helpful in our time and in our society to think about. So, when I looked at Philemon and its 25 verses, I thought, well, we'll treat it not like a McDonald's, we'll treat it like an evening out somewhere. We'll take it slow through the meal rather than rush through it. Now, today, what I want to do is introduce the letter, just with two parts to the introduction. I'm going to talk firstly about the area that Paul is writing to. So we'll talk about its geography and its reputation. Where did this letter go to? this place, the Lycus Valley. And then we'll talk a little bit about the event that sat behind the letter. This split between the slave and the master. So let's start with the area. Now, if this works, and it does, we do a map. I don't do maps very often, so it's an exciting moment. Matteo, focus on that map, because you ought to know that map, because your family come from here, but not from where we're talking about. Matteo, you're not allowed to shout out, but if I walk across towards the map, do you want to put your hand up the moment I get near where your daddy came from? You ready? Here we go. I'm watching you. You've got to tell me when I'm getting near.
There!
Okay, you did the shout out, but we'll trust that's okay. Into it. This is the Mediterranean Sea. And of course, above you've got European and the Slavic countries, you've got Africa below, you've got the Middle East to the right. The islands, the famous islands of Crete and Cyprus in there. After the church began in Jerusalem, down here, it moved out into the Mediterranean world, of course, and started to flow round. Some of it did go south. Very early on, there's a convert from Ethiopia, which is not the country we think of, but an area of Africa, quite a big area in those days. But we think of it particularly as going to the north of the Mediterranean and the Apostle Paul and his mission work. Well, as it came up from Jerusalem, one of the first most famous churches, became a well-known church for many years afterwards, was in Antioch, Syrian Antioch. That's over here on the right where the red arrow is, right at the far end of the Mediterranean on its eastern end. But then from there, Paul and his helpers, people like Barnabas and Silas, Timothy and others, they moved out from Antioch. They went across, Paul and Barnabas, to Cyprus, the big island off the coast where Barnabas had come from. Then they went up into Turkey, the whole big area above. Now, it's not called Turkey on this map, because they didn't call it Turkey. They knew it by other names, a whole range of different names. We talk about it sometimes in the Bible as Asia Minor. I think that was not how they'd have thought of it, but it was a later name given to it to try and sum up that area. Now, Paul went to a number of cities, and we've looked at some of those in Acts, but other workers who were part of Paul's team would go out from him maybe, or for other reasons, would travel to other cities to evangelise. One of them was Epaphras. And Epaphras took the gospel to Colossae, where he came from. Now again, you can see in the middle there, another red arrow, and it's pointing at three tiny dots. And if you can read the writing on the dots, which you may not be able to do, Monica certainly can't. She'll be popping into the optometrist sometime this week. Okay, we'll blame the projector, it's fine. It is very small writing. But where it's pointing, there are three names, three little dots. Hierapolis, Laodicea, and Colossae. Now that's really difficult to read, but it may give you a better idea of the terrain. Because there's a lot of little mountains or little hills and mountains and all sorts through the area. And it's tricky to see, but if you can see, the three cities again are here where the red arrow is. And you can see a valley running down there, a green bit, compared with the mountains either side. Over on the coast here, you've got Ephesus, but you've got this valley. There's a well-known river that runs down across ways, the meander, which you may recognise from an English word we use, meandering. But down here, you've got this Lycus Valley and three cities, Hierapolis, Laodicea and Colossae. The area is an area of earthquakes. Not surprisingly, I guess, but you've heard of Turkish earthquakes in the modern era. And indeed, when Paul wrote his letter, it was possibly around the time of one of the most famous that struck those cities. In the early 60s, Laodicea was smashed by an earthquake. But then It was an amazing place in some ways. The city rebuilt itself, and unusually, it rebuilt itself without government help. I don't say that just because governments we think of helping today, but people would appeal to the imperial rulers to help in time of disaster. But Laodicea didn't. It was a rich city, had a flourishing wool trade, created a great deal of wealth for itself, and so it just rebuilt. And that was in the early 60s AD. I think by the 62, I think it would started to get back up on its feet. Now, that's a remarkable thing, an amazing thing. In some ways for the church, that fact about Laodicea was also a little bit sad. If you remember the letter in Revelation, then you will remember what the Lord Jesus called the church in Laodicea. He said it was lukewarm. What did he mean by that? Nothing to do with his fellow worker, Luke. All about water. Three cities in the Lycus Valley. If you were in Hierapolis, you had amazing hot springs that would flow into the city. So you imagine what you could do with hot water. You could wash, you could bathe, all kinds of things. If you lived in Colossae, you had access to beautiful cold water, where it's great for drinking and refreshing when it's boiling hot, as it could get there. But Laodicea, your water was piped in. By the time it got to you, it was tepid. And what do you do with tepid water? It's just bleh. You don't particularly wash well in it, and you don't really feel like drinking it till it's cooled down completely. So it was just lukewarm. Jesus said of the Laodicea church just a few years later, "That's how I find you. Bleh. You're just lukewarm." And what did he mean by that? He meant you're not good for one thing or the other. We can sometimes think lukewarm means, oh, you need to warm up and be really excited to be a Christian. He doesn't mean that. He's not talking about being excited about being a Christian. What he means is, you're just no good for anything. If you were hot, I could wash with you. If you were cold, I could drink you. But you're just tepid. I don't know what I can do with you. And then when he goes on to talk about it in that letter in Revelation, he says, because you're rich in your heads and in your bank accounts. The church in Laodicea had become self-confident. It had the resources to do anything. Like the city had. Rebuild yourself after an earthquake. But it had trusted that money to the degree where it no longer trusted the Lord but itself. And the Lord Jesus wrote that letter to that church in Laodicea and called them back from their pride in their wealth. The good thing was, it seemed to work. And that in coming centuries, that church did thrive for the gospel. Now that is the future. I mean, that's maybe 10 years further on when that letter from Jesus through John arrives. Here, when Paul's writing, what does he see? Well, when Paul writes to the Lycus Valley, and he writes particularly to Colossae, but also this letter to Philemon, but we know of another letter that we don't have. If we go to Colossians, we see two important points about these churches, or at least the area and so forth. Point number one is that bad ideas had infected the church. I'm not going to read from Colossians 2 at this moment, but if you were to read Colossians 2 later on, you would read all about this. There were gifted teachers, they come into the church in Colossae, and they were leading Christians astray. They were clever, but they were deceptive. They emphasised old traditions, but they were distracting people. They were distracting people from Jesus Christ. They got people's minds caught up in all kinds of other ideas. And in particular, they went on about how the Christian life really centred on how you handled material things, how you dealt with them, how you interacted with the stuff of this world. But then they like to balance that with a bit of spiritual stuff too. So they also like to talk about angels and how you could get in touch with angels and worship angels in the unseen world. It had really muddled the church up, and Paul had to say, look, come back from this stuff, it's nonsense. Going on about angels, worshipping angels, going on about touch this, don't touch that, watch how you go with this. May well be, of course, because they were wealthy that they had time for all this rubbish. If you're too busy just working 12 hours a day trying to survive, you haven't got time to faff about with worshipping angels and worrying about whether you're touching the right type of clothing. You're too busy doing your job and being shattered at the end of the day. Maybe their wealth played into this, I don't know. But of course, Paul could speak powerfully to it because his own life had been like this. You remember Paul when he was Saul? And he was this ardent Jewish nationalist and a great keeper of the law. And his whole life was caught up in the thought of, I mustn't eat that. Oh, I've touched that. I must go and wash straight away. What did I do last Saturday? Oh, what's the day coming up in the calendar? Oh, I've got to... He could write to Colossae and say, stop faffing about. Focus on the big things that matter. And he would talk to them about Christ and what Christ had done. So, what were these churches that Paul was writing to? Churches in the Lycus Valley. What do we know about them? Well, we certainly know from Colossians what one of them was like. And given their close links, they were probably all like it. There were some bad ideas roaming around in them. Some troublesome ideas. But there was something else that worried Paul about the Lycus Valley. It wasn't just the teaching or the discussions that they were having, but it was the attitude within them. Now, the cultural attitude there in the Lycus Valley comes through in Colossians 3. How did it arise? Well, again, it may have arisen because of the wealth of the valley, possibly that reason. Because they thought of themselves as tough people. You knock us down, we build ourselves back up. We take anything and we move on. Because possibly that, a harshness was true of the cities. They were tough, but they were harsh. So they would talk with a brutality and a cruelty. Listen to what Paul wrote to them in Colossians 3. This time I will read from Colossians. I don't have it on the screen, but I'll read it to you. Colossians 3, verses 8 to 10. Listen to what Paul says to these Christians. You must rid yourselves of all such things as these. Anger. Rage. Malice. Slander. And filthy language from your lips. And don't think of filthy there as sort of sexually immoral or something. Just think of it in terms of nastiness, in terms of how you're talking with others, a brutality within it. Do not lie to each other, since you have taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. Now, it was no doubt a church of all kinds of people. I don't suppose Paul's saying every single Colossian Christian you ever met committed every one of these sins all the time. He's summarising. No doubt there was difference between people. Some people were more naturally shy, diffident, quiet, easygoing. But even so, Paul could write to that church in Colossae and he could sum up the cultural effect on its citizens, including the Christians. You've got to get rid of some of these attitudes, he said, some of this anger and rage and malice and slander and filthy language and lying. And you can imagine, you know, some of the relationships in which those things would be especially true. And one of them is the relationship here in Philemon. There are masters and slaves in the Lycus Valley, in Colossae and Hierapolis and Laodicea. How do you think the masters would talk to the people below them? Just do it. Do you remember the quote earlier in when we read Philemon, when he's writing to this man and he says to him, "You think of your slave as useless." You can imagine the master just shouting that, can't you? "You are useless. I don't know why I keep you." Paul says, you need to learn to get rid of this way of talking you have. So you can imagine that it particularly came out in those divisions within their society. And one of the great cultural, social divisions, or whatever, would be that class division between, or status division between, the masters and the slaves. But then, what do you think it was like down in the kitchen? Do you think the slaves all got down there and sat around the table and said, "Well, yeah, the master's a bit hard on us, but he's a lovely bloke underneath it all"? Oh, you can imagine how they swore about the master. Every slander possible would have been told. Paul says, this must change. It's easy for us to understand such a culture, isn't it? You think of how language is used in our own society, the sharpness and the brutality that's come in, the way in which words that once would have been for moments of great emphasis or drama become commonplace. You think of how foul words just are everyday language. And you think especially of things like social media and the way people discuss things with one another and how quickly it can deteriorate. We can understand what it might have felt like, some of the things Paul was dealing with. So what was this place, what was that Lycus Valley like where Paul was writing to? It was rich, it was obsessed with ridiculous ideas, it had vicious talk and it had social division. Not really so far removed from our society, is it? You know, before we go on, it says to us that we have to take great care, doesn't it? John in Revelation, or Jesus through John, Paul here says to Christians, take care in the culture you move in. Don't assume that its patterns of life, which will very easily become your patterns of life, are right. You may just take things on. They may just have been there since ever you grew up. And you just think that's the way you do things. That's how you talk to that person. Because everybody talks to them that way. And Paul and John say to us, now you've got to learn somehow to step back and stare at your culture. And see what is harming you as a Christian. We have to learn to step back and look at ourselves and say, am I being harmed by too much comfort? That was Laodicea. No one wants to live in poverty. It's grinding, it's depressing, and it's fearful. But we have to be careful that we are not just living lives reliant on money, because we're in a rich society. Yeah, this week, the Chancellor of the Exchequer talked about how we're going to spend our way out of the economic crisis brought about by the virus, the decline. And maybe it will help. But as Christians, we don't build life hoping that money will solve the problem. We remember tepid Laodicea. It became useless. And yet, they could rebuild their city from scratch. Similarly, you know, we've got to step back, haven't we? We've got to hear how we talk. Do we talk just like the culture around us because we've just assumed it must be right? Yeah, you listen to our culture, it gets obsessed, doesn't it? There's some big idea. This is the thing that needs to be done now. This is the thing that must change. Or it gets caught up in political philosophy. This is now the way to do politics, and this will bring a fairer society. Or it gets caught up in spiritual ideas. We're also terribly depressed in the West, but here is something that will pick us back up and put us on our feet and get rid of the depression. Or it goes on about lifestyle. Oh, we used to think we should live this way, but now we live that way. We used to think we should eat this, but now we eat that. And we're so much better for it. And our culture goes round and round on all these things. Then it launches its campaigns. And you wear the t-shirt and you type the hashtag and you put up the flag or the poster, whatever it is. And at last, things will be right in our time and justice will be done. As Christians, we have to learn to stand back and actually think about, hang on, what is going on here? And how much of this am I just taking in, not thinking about? Because you know what? Maybe you're thinking, you know, that idea I've heard about, that sounds really good. You know, actually, I mean, I know it's not come from Christians, but it's a good idea. You know what you'll find, though? 2 months' time, it'll be dropped. There'll be another big idea to follow. Are you going to carry on chasing round after the next big idea? Or you'll see people within a culture and they'll expose something as evil and they'll say, look at how terrible this is. And you'll think, you're absolutely right. That is terrible, isn't it? And then you'll suddenly find that even while you're patting them on the back, they're telling you about something else that they also think is really good. And you're thinking, but that's terrible, that's evil. Why are you promoting that? And you find that the very thing you're, the moment you're patting them on the back saying, yes, you're right, that was good to notice, they're promoting something else where you think, oh no. And why is all of this? Because all of this is rooted in the fickle whims of humanity. Because the culture will constantly shift and change and tell you the next thing that matters, quickly forgetting that something else mattered 5 minutes ago. And Christians get swept along with it. But we have to be careful. We have to have the capacity to stand back. I mean, you see it very dramatically in our generation by how quickly yesterday's radicals are today's figures of contempt. So when I was growing up, there were certain people who were seen as the radicals on the edge driving for a new society, the rebels saying outrageous things that nobody else was saying. Those very same people are not yet dead. They're still alive, but now they're the ones who are getting hammered for being troublesome in the way they do things, troublesome in the way they say things, old-fashioned, stuck in a different viewpoint. And the modern radicals now condemn the old radicals. And you don't think the modern radicals are going to be condemned in 20 years' time? And then the next, and then the next. And then in all of this, how easily the language becomes brutal. You listen to the names that some of the new radicals call the old radicals. It's vicious. They are really vicious. As Christians, we have to learn to stand back from our culture and not just presume whatever it's saying is right and good and the way to go is correct. We have to learn to somehow to step ourselves out of it and to look. And especially, Christians are to counteract it by saying, okay, so what do I focus on then? And the answer is the kingdom of heaven. And if people think that means, oh, you mean think about one day you'll die and be with Jesus and that's how you live life. No, because you haven't read the Gospels. The kingdom of heaven is an alternative kingdom in the here and now, in this world. It is people coming out of all that confusion and sin of the cultures of the world and under Christ becoming part of something better, which is built on God's great and glorious truth, and where real eternal hope lies and where true justice is found. So as we think about those churches in the Lycus Valley and we see some of their problems that arose from the culture they were in, and we ask ourselves, well, what have I just imbibed from my culture around me? What do I just take for granted? And in fact, I've just sucked it in from around me. We also then refocus and say, so what should I look at? And the answer is, I look at the kingdom that Christ has launched. And that's where my life now flows from, what he is doing. So, to sum up where we've been to so far in Philemon, we've just talked about dangers in the Lycus Valley. There's a place confident in its wealth. We thought about that. The was placed misled by popular ideas. We talked a little about that. And it was marked by harsh attitudes and by harsh talk. Now, point two. What's the big issue behind Paul's letter? Well, as Paul was writing this letter, he will have known it was one which clashed deeply with the social order of the Lycus Valley, that he really was standing outside of the culture and calling into it to be different. Indeed, Paul knew that he was writing radical ideas that would clash with the whole of the Roman Empire, because Philemon is a letter about slavery. Paul is in prison when he writes it. He's most likely either in Ephesus or Rome. There's discussion as to which one he's in. We've seen the imprisonment in Rome briefly in the book of Acts. If it is Rome, which I'm inclined to think it is, then we're in the early 60s. If it's Ephesus, though, it'd be a few years earlier. And the story is this. While imprisoned, a slave came and found Paul. Now, this slave had left his master without permission. In the empire, that could be a crime. You're just running away. A common punishment for it was once you were caught and brought back, they would burn the skin off your feet because you ran away. But equally, there were other options. A slave could flee his master in order to go to another household and beg that master to take him in. And say to the new master, please, will you mediate with my previous master and may I not be punished for doing this? So there were alternatives. But whatever the situation was, it happened to Paul. He's imprisoned, but a slave comes to him who has run from his master and found Paul. The two came to know each other. They came to know each other well, as we see in the letter. But it reached a point where Paul felt, I've got to send this slave back. He's going to have to go back to his master. And this master was a Christian down in the Lycus Valley. Now, we might judge Paul for that, I guess. At the very least, we might think, you can't send him back to Lycus. Do you know how they talk about slaves there? I can only imagine how they treat them. Or we might judge Paul and simply say, at the more philosophical level, Paul, what are you doing? Why are you supporting slavery? Surely slavery is a great wickedness, Paul. You've got people being literally bought and sold like cattle. Well, as we continue with the letter, we're going to have to talk more about that. Why did Paul feel able to do this? But for the rest of this sermon, let me just highlight one thing. Though on the surface it may seem like Paul is giving in to the culture, accepting slavery, actually his actions utterly undermine it. And that's because Paul takes the event of sending the slave home to reshape the church the slave was returning to. In Philemon 1, verses 15 and 16, Paul writes this. Perhaps the reason he was separated from you for a little while is that you might have him back for good. No longer as a slave, but better than a slave, as a dear brother. He is very dear to me, but even dearer to you, both as a man and as a brother in the Lord. Paul says, yeah, I'm sending your slave back. But if you think I'm just saying the status quo is fine, we should live with it. Think again, he says. I am pleading with you to change. When this slave returns, will you see him as a brother? That was a shocking thing for him to do. It would shock the slave and the master. It would have an impact on the whole church. That would ripple out to the other Christians in the Lycus Valley because of the strong links between the cities. And it would trigger reaction from the society around them. The cost could be huge when Paul wrote those little words. I'm sending back a runaway slave. Treat him as a brother. Sounds simple, doesn't it? Not simple at all. So when we read Paul's little note, don't think of him just as handling a sensitive pastoral issue between two people. Paul's little note, and surely this is why the Holy Spirit's kept it in the Bible, could be a catalyst, something small, for great change. By itself, you might not appreciate that completely, but if you read Colossians and you read Ephesians with it, you start to see the power in Philemon to be a living example of how the gospel draws people together across apparently insurmountable divides. Now, that will have lessons for us as we go on in the series. But let's wrap up for today. And let's wrap up just thinking, just as we close, about catalysts, which is how I described it. Catalyst is a word that comes from science, but we use it socially. And we mean a small event that helps a big change to occur. Now, of course, first century churches were already coping with the thought of slaves and masters both becoming Christians, and they were wrestling with what that looked like. But sometimes you need a useful moment or a useful event which drives the teaching home. That's a catalyst. Now, I don't know for sure that Paul saw it that way, how important he felt the return of the slave would be for the whole group of Christians in the valley. But it had that possibility. That the ideas that Paul might write about in Colossians and Ephesians came to life when people looked at the slave and his master and how they treated one another, even after the slave had run away. As Christians, we should value catalyst moments, useful moments. Yeah, you do. You just take one tiny example. Let's say, I don't know, there's some... you've tried to get to know a neighbour of yours, and you've tried for years to get to know them, but they're just really difficult to talk to, and you're not naturally able to engage with them, and so you never really have... It's never really happened. And then one day, their car doesn't start. And you're walking by, and you're on your way to work, but you stop. And you give them time, and you help them, and you get it going. And after that, your conversation with that neighbour is never the same again. You might have tried for years to get to talk to them, and it never really happened beyond a sort of nod and a hello in the street. But one moment, one little event, a broken car, changed everything. It was a useful moment. It was a catalyst for change. That's a small example. Paul's working with a bigger one. But we should pray for such moments, because they're important. There are situations that weigh on your heart, and maybe for years you've carried it around and you've prayed about it and you've wanted to see change. Maybe you thought for a long time about some new opportunity to serve the Lord, but you've never found out quite how to do it and how to go about it. Maybe for a long time there's been a broken relationship within your life, something that hasn't worked and you can't repair it, and you've tried and it's never happened. Maybe there's some development within the life of the church. You've thought, will our church ever move in that way? Will it ever improve that area? Or whatever it may be. But it's something where you've prayed about it and you've tried to say things and you've thought about how it could change, and it never has. You've never made progress. Pray the Lord will give an event to help, a useful moment. You see, it's not always enough to do the right thing. Sometimes you need the right moment. One of the things we should pray for are those moments to come, those catalysts for change, those things that will trigger what we're looking to happen. You know, that can, once you've realised that it's not just enough always just, but look, I'm doing all the right steps, why is this not changing? Once you've realised that sometimes it needs just the right moment to come from the Lord, that can be quite comforting, because we can all be frustrated by things that don't change. And we can sometimes just feel it's our fault. Well, I just haven't tried hard enough, I'm just too lazy, I'm just too cowardly, I'm just too stupid. Well, that, all those may be true. But it actually might just be that you need to be a bit more patient. Just wait and pray for the catalyst to be provided by the Lord. And when it comes, use it. Of course, course, you might then say, well, what if I miss it? You know, what if the Lord gives me this great opportunity? I've been waiting for it and praying for it and I miss it. What then? Well, you'll probably get a bit upset. But that's okay. You know, life's full of upsets. It's not sinful. I mean, remember, you know, sin is where we disobey God, or we go, you know, or we go against his word, or we fail to do what his word says. It's not a sin to miss an opportunity, but it is upsetting. But in which case, learn from the upset and say, right, well, I'll keep my eyes open for the next time, because God's very gracious. When we throw his opportunities away, he goes and gives another one. But the point is this, as we close, there are just, sometimes we need the Lord to actually provide the moment, provide the event, give the catalyst for change. Philemon's a great example of that. And in those things that weigh on your heart, pray that you would see the same.